Hello, everybody, and welcome to the podcast Reinventing Global Health. The topic today is global health and healthcare research, and my guest is Dr. Aaron Ben-David. Dr. Ben-David is an associate professor of medicine, primary care, and population health at Stanford University. He's a senior fellow at Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment, senior fellow by courtesy at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. He's a member of BioX, is a faculty affiliate at the Institute for Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence, and a member at the Maternal and Child Health Research Institute. His work broadly investigates the drivers of population health improvements in developing countries. He studies how economic, political, and natural environments affect population health, and he uses a mix of experimental, econometric, qualitative modeling, and demographic tools to produce insights and strategies for improving health. A sample of current project address the following question. What effect do malaria control programs have on child mortality? What combination of prevention strategies are most cost-effective for Africa's HIV epidemic? And which populations are most vulnerable to the effects of climate conditions on the availability of food? And his clinical focus is infectious disease. So before I start my first question, Aaron, is there anything you want to add or maybe update us on this, your background?
Thank you, Ian. I'm pleased to be here. I'm excited about this podcast series, and I'm grateful for the opportunity. My mother would be very proud of this introduction, so thank you.
Okay, well, let's go directly to the first question, which is, and you can take as long as you want to answer this, there's no time limit. From a healthcare perspective, based on your personal experience and beyond, what is the importance of healthcare research in global health?
So before I delve into this question directly, I want to tease apart an important issue, and that is that healthcare research and healthcare broadly is a distinct from actually health. So here's what I mean by that. There are a lot of things that we do as part of healthcare. We have people come to the doctor. We provide vaccinations. These are all very important parts of healthcare. There are some parts of healthcare that are their impact on health is less well known, especially more advanced diagnostics, some screening options. We recently saw some studies that really bring raise questions about the importance of certain screening for health conditions. And so healthcare has some things that promote health and some things that do not. In addition, there are lots of things that people do that matter for their health that really have little to do with healthcare. For example, choice about exercise and where to live and a lot of personal choices make a lot of difference for health and are not part of healthcare. So with this distinction, I think there's almost two separate questions about the importance of healthcare research. And for that, I would say, for me, the most important aspect is this notion of, are we providing healthcare that makes a difference for people's health? I think it's particularly important in the global health context because the resources are pretty scarce, and we want to make sure that every investment we make has a positive value. Otherwise, if we invest dollars, we put money in a particular intervention and it doesn't make much of a difference, well, that amount of money could have made a difference being put somewhere else. So that's the importance of healthcare research. And I think that the importance of health, of global health research, is really to understand what are the things that make a difference. It's pretty clear that vaccines make a difference, but how about things that are a little bit less clear about screening for tuberculosis? We don't know what are the screening options that are going to make a big difference, whether to use the skin testing or Various other technologies. And so understanding what makes a difference for actual health is an important aspect, and there are lots of open questions that remain to be seen.
Okay, thank you, Aaron. What about big data? What is the importance of big data in global health?
So I would say that there are a few aspects of big data that are important in the health, in the global health research sphere. One is, there are lots of questions in biomedical research that it's really hard to answer. Commonly, when we have a specific question about a new medical intervention, let's say a new pill for hypertension or for cholesterol, we will put it to test in a clinical trial, in a randomized trial, and then we figure out the answer. We saw that with the vaccines for COVID. That was an impressive set of trials that really gave us important answers to hard questions. For most questions, it's really hard to put clinical trials there. They can be either prohibitively expensive or unethical or questionable on a host of dimensions. So the next best way to answer a lot of these questions is to try to look at very, very large numbers of people, because then you can really understand impacts. If you apply observations and methods to study populations. And so, it's really, big data is our way of understanding large-scale impacts in the absence of, for questions and for in the absence of randomized trials. A lot of things, one of my favorite areas of research is foreign aid for health. There's not going to be a randomized experiment. The U.S. is not going to choose, we're going to provide aid to this country and not to that country randomly. We're not going to toss a coin and do that. And so, in order to understand whether foreign aid makes a difference and where does it make a difference, one has to rely on large amounts of data, and those data, fortunately, in the global health context, there are a few very large data sets that have been collected over many years and have provided an incredible value for the global health research community.
Okay, I understand. This is for basically the clinical field. What about the link between global health, public health, and big data? Public health being different in the sense that it would include the behavior, the socioeconomic circumstances, and so on.
Increasingly we are aware of how health is interconnected with a lot of other structures. With obviously, increasingly we're aware of how social structures, historical features of how a society is put together. Issues of socioeconomic differences and race differences make a big difference for how people are treated. In addition, there are a lot of other large societal structures that make a difference. And so politics makes a big difference for health, right? Increasingly, we're aware of the way that climate and climate change is important for health. For these kinds of topics, large amounts of data are the best way that we can get a clear view of the impact of political issues, of social issues, of economic issues on health. So I think those are all, in fact, in most of the insightful, most kind of important research in the linking between social aspects, environmental aspects, political, economic, and health, all come from very large data sets.
Okay, thank you. Now, as you say, global health, it depends upon different policies. And in the policies, there's, of course, the politics, influence. How do you see that? What is the influence of politics in healthcare research?
I'll tell you about one of our studies that exemplifies that. in the United States, since the days of President Reagan in the 80s, there are some policies that are clearly just a tool for a political tool. And you can tell that that's a political tool, because every time that the presidency changes from Republicans to Democrats, or Republicans to Democrats, they flip this policy right away, the first week in office. And one of those policies is called the Mexico City policy. And the Mexico City policy is so-called because it was initially enacted in Mexico City, but it's a policy where the United States decides whether or not its foreign aid for family planning or for reproductive health can be used to support clinics that either promote or perform abortions, okay? And so whenever a Republican gets elected into office, they prohibit U.S. support, U.S. foreign aid from supporting any kind of family planning or reproductive health organizations that have abortion as part of their repertoire. And every time a Democrat gets into office, they enable that. Okay, so it gets flipped on and off and on and off and on and off. We decided to look at that and look at what happens downstream. So organizations that depend on U.S. foreign aid for family planning, for reproductive health support in West Africa and East Africa, when this policy gets flipped, either on or off, they see big changes to their operations. And in fact, what you end up seeing is that these organizations that you know, organizations such as Planned Parenthood, they provide not just abortion care, they also provide a lot of other contraceptive and family planning care. So when the political decision gets made, those organizations see a big difference when they're better supported, they're better able to provide family planning and contraceptives. When the support gets cut off, they are unable to provide family planning and contraceptives anymore. And in fact, what you see is an increase in abortion because women don't have access to contraceptives or as much access as they had before. And so this policy that is intended in some ways to prevent support for abortions actually has the downstream consequence of leading to increased abortions. And so this is an example of where political decisions have real-world consequences. And in fact, the real-world consequences are could be quite counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think you have a counterexample, which is the PEPFAR. PEPFAR, initiated by a Republican president, George Bush. And you have quite an experience with this in South Africa.
So, for sure. I have become, through my research, a big supporter of PEPFAR. So PEPFAR was started in 2003 by then President George W. Bush. It was partly a political decision, partly really he was moved by that steamrolling HIV epidemic that was destroying a lot of countries, especially in the southern portion of sub-Saharan Africa. He really put a lot of heft behind U.S. support for providing medications for people with HIV, and this program has been responsible for an enormous expansion of medications, of antiretrovirals for HIV in sub-Saharan Africa. We have demonstrated time and time again how that has allowed enormous health gains, reduction in mortality, especially for adults, for parents, fewer orphans, because the children, their parents manage to thrive and live well, as well as economic benefits to the labor force. And so all these beneficial consequences of this aid. So this was an example of a program that was well-designed, targeted an important health concern that had a very good solution in the sense of these medications that make a huge difference in people's lives. And so we can see the consequences all the way down to survival. There was an interesting stipulation in PEPFAR, in this program, that said that about a third of all prevention money was supposed to go to abstinence and faithfulness programs. All the backroom dealings that led to that happening, I don't have too much insight, but a lot of folks think that it was a political bargain to make both more conservative and more kind of right wing aspects of the original program, make it all accessible or make it all feasible for passing Congress. Now, so this stipulation that about a third of prevention dollars are supposed to go to abstinence only programs. You can again kind of try to see, does it make a difference for people's behavior, sexual behavior, and faithfulness and partnership patterns? And we looked at that, and you know, those are very tough behaviors to change. You're trying to ask people to change things that are very important, very culturally ingrained, very personal. And when we have tried to look at that, we could see absolutely no difference of these this PEPFAR money for prevention, for changing personal behavior, on rates of teen pregnancy, on the number of partners, and on family structures in sub-Saharan Africa. And so this is an example of, again, you know, potentially a political aspect to a health program that is, you know, the consequences were not known and were important to identify through research.
Mm-hmm. And more specifically, how did this impact, PEPFAR, impacted your research, your funding, for example? Did you have benefit?
Well, I think for a health researcher, for a policy researcher, the greatest reward is to have your research impact policy, right? And in the case of PEPFAR, you know, my research was included in a lot of the congressional reports on PEPFAR that came back to Congress. A lot of my research was involved in some of the discussions about renewing and refinancing or providing renewed support from Congress to PEPFAR. And so this was this is the greatest reward. If I had direct support from PEPFAR, you know, in some ways I have kept my independence from PEPFAR as a way of saying, look, it's important to have somebody who has a clear-eyed and unaffiliated, in the sense of no financial support, no financial ties to PEPFAR directly, have them be able to assess PEPFAR. And I think in some ways that's been beneficial to everyone, because there's a lot of trust in this kind of research that does not have any financial motives at all whatsoever.
Thank you, Aaron. This is a good segue for my next question, which will be, how do you maintain independence? And maybe we can talk about how is healthcare research funded at Stanford?
Yeah. So how do we maintain independence? You know, I should say that I consider that an important point. And so in some ways it is a deliberate choice, and it doesn't always happen this way for in research. Oftentimes, you can see that experts actually get involved with the companies or with the commercial aspects of the things that they are an expert on, and that's intuitive. It's understandable. In fact, you know, a lot of expert panels are comprised of folks that are involved with the commercial development of particular drugs or whatnot, and it makes sense. They're you know, that these are the people that really do have the deepest expertise. That said, the issue of retaining trust in the process, in the research, in the findings is central to and so I have, throughout my career, maintained this kind of independent view, and I am both sympathetic to a lot of decisions, and at the same time, that still does not prevent me from taking a very critical look and very close look at the impacts and the outcomes of organizations. You mentioned we looked at malaria programs. We've looked at family planning programs, as I mentioned, HIV, and so that's an important part of it. So then your question is, well, you know, if you maintain independence, how do you keep your research? Yeah, there are several answers to that. I would say that my favorite sources of research and the ones I appreciate the most come from NIH. And part of the reason why I appreciate that is that when NIH funds this kind of research, it's not just enabling for me, but it's also an indication that NIH values this kind of work. And it values the independence that comes with it. It values the answers. It values the information. It sees the policy impact. And so that's my kind of most cherished source of funding. It's hard because NIH is very well tooled for basic research, for basic discovery, but it's not. It doesn't quite have the same interest in or the same expertise in policy relevant research. So it's not always a simple process. And at the same time, once it does happen, it's extraordinarily valuable. I'll say increasingly, we also have funding from NIH for climate change research, and so that the health impacts of climate change in low-income countries and global health. And again, it's an indication that NIH cares about that. That it's it is a priority for them to understand and measure these issues.
Thank you. Do you have an idea of the breakdown of research funds here allocated to Stanford? How much is coming from NIH? How much is coming from other sources? And what would be those sources?
Well, it's a good question, and a little bit brings up the point that if really all I relied on was NIH, there would be a lot of things that I wouldn't be able to investigate because that process is arduous and can be quite long, as part of the research here for Stanford for global health, there's a combination of federal funds from NIH, sometimes from the National Science Foundation as well. One interesting angle of funding here, and I don't see too much of that, but I know there's some. Is from the local community. Now, we live in Silicon Valley. There's a lot of money around here, and a lot of philanthropy actually that is around here. Now, the question often is, why would philanthropists in Silicon Valley care about global health? And the answer is, one is they kind of recognize the humanitarian value of global health research and global health as a priority. And increasingly, COVID kind of brought that to the fore, is the interconnectedness of what happens in other countries to what we see and how we experience the experience in our world. And so, philanthropic support for research is, COVID in some ways made it easy to connect those dots and say, look, when we try to look at emergence of new pathogens, control of diseases in other countries, that makes a difference for everybody's lives, including our life here.
Can you talk a little bit about the mismatch between funding and public health priorities in developing countries? Well, where is it coming from? What would be the solutions?
What you are referring to is the fact that, for example, something like HIV funding makes up a very large portion of let's say, U.S. funding for global health, close to half. And at the same time, HIV is a relatively small portion of burden, maybe 5-10% in of deaths or disability-adjusted life years in low and middle income countries. And so, how do you explain this kind of discrepancy, and what are the implications? There are a few ways that I can answer that. One is to think, should we have global health funding be aligned with public health priorities, right? Should the US, let's say, that we think that childhood pneumonia makes up 5% of global burden, should we allocate 5% of our funding for childhood pneumonia? And the answer is, perhaps it would have a sense of being equitable this way, but it's not necessarily the best use of that money for a few reasons. One is there are some diseases that are just very expensive to treat. So, an example of that is, something like cancer. A lot of cancers are require chemotherapy and a lot of resources, sometimes surgeries. Those can be quite intensive in terms of resource needs. So, cancer is a large cause of burden. But if you invested in cancer, you wouldn't be, there'd be a lot of other diseases that you wouldn't be able to address. Okay, there are some. And on the flip side of that, here's the other kind of the counterexample. There are lots of diseases that may not make a huge burden, but they're so, in some ways, inexpensive to treat that you can make a huge dent with relatively few resources. And so our standard vaccines for measles, mumps, rubella, for tetanus and diphtheria and pertussis, those are, the vaccines are extraordinarily cheap. A lot of the public health systems that distribute vaccines are really pretty efficient. And so these diseases don't cause a lot of burden anymore, but at the same time, they're taking care of those kinds of vaccinations and vaccine programs is a very, very good use of money.
Okay? Well, I beg to differ a little bit here because I studied a little bit.
Neonatal
and maternal tetanus.
Yes.
In East Africa, 100,000 deaths per year.
Totally. Still,
and the cost of a tetanus vaccine, the series of three, is $1.
It's nothing, right?
So compare this to a year-long treatment with HIV.
Totally.
So how many? And here's my second thing, which is my favorite topic actually, is prioritization. We know we have limited funds. We know that the demand exceeds the supply. We have to prioritize.
Exactly.
You cannot reason the same way with the Hippocratic Oath. Hippocratic Oath goes through the window at the emergency room. You have to triage,
I agree entirely. It's exactly my point, right? So, in some level, if you need to prioritize, and because for global health, especially, in the U.S., the healthcare system here is, it's like over $1 trillion, like, maybe $2 trillion a year, right? I mean, there is a sense that when you go into a hospital here, there's never any kind of ceiling on the resources, right? It's like you go in here and it's like all expenses are, that's not the case with global health. And you go to hospitals and there is no antibiotics or there is no, kind of surgical devices. The surgery room doesn't have the autoclave working. Things like that happen all the time, right? And so the sense that resources are limited is palpable. And so this question of, okay, given that resources are limited, how do we make the best use of what we have? Until we get to the point where, we provide more support for global health, right? Which is a different conversation. We can talk about that. But given that we have what we have, how do we prioritize? And so to your question of, you could do a lot more vaccines than HIV medications. Yes, I see your point, and for sure, global health funding could be more efficient. But I'll tell you, and I've done some work on that. By and large, the funding goes in the right direction. And by that, I mean, you have more funding going to malaria bed nets than to cancer and cardiovascular disease, right? And that's a little bit as it should be. And so now HIV in some ways is the elephant in the room because it does get a lot of funding. But the overall direction of global health funding is kind of, it's broadly in the right direction, with the caveat that it could be a lot more efficient. And the places where you can make a lot more difference with funding actually are maternal and child health. Tuberculosis is one of these things where treatment for tuberculosis is pennies. you know, for a full course, and it's a huge burden. And we don't have nearly enough, and same with malaria. These are the kind of the areas, the kind of big areas of global health that if I said, you know, where can we make more of a difference? It would be in providing more emphasis and support for these programs.
Mm-hmm. So given what you said, what are the main challenges for healthcare research?
You know, in global health, you know, I think that, you know, here, and again, I would kind of distinguish two types of global health research. One is research in a particular country. So, you know, we used to have a few projects in Zambia and in Kenya. And so, you know, you want to look at, let's say, a program for providing clean water or chlorination and for households. And so you do the research in the country. That's important. That's an important type of global health research. A second type of research, which some people call research about global public goods. And by that, I mean goods that they're global in the sense that they are borderless in some sense, and that improving those goods, you know, does good things to everybody. And so, you know, a classic one, of course, is on everybody's mind these days is emerging pathogen. And so trying to identify new pathogens that are coming up in the Mekong Delta or wherever, you know, trying to identify them early, collaborating across research or across biomedical platforms in different countries, right? So, you know, if we have very good communication with biomedical platforms in other countries, we can do, we can act quicker. Guidelines, you know, is another type of global public good. You know, if we have clear guidelines that other countries don't have to develop their own, that, you know, so those are the kinds of global public goods. You know, my sense is that in historically the research in global public goods has been underfunded in the sense that that the benefits can be quite large. Post COVID, I haven't seen the numbers and I haven't done the research yet, but my sense is that there's going to be a lot of money going just for emerging pathogen detection, and you know, I know several large funding agencies are really, you know, diverting an enormous amount of support just for that purpose, and that a lot of other things are going to get actually underfunded, especially a lot of kind of within country research, and the last point I would say is that I think that research should be tied to the priority setting. And so, for example, you know, I mentioned TB, you know, there are a lot of questions about various management options, and especially about screening and early identification. You know, part of the reason why it's really hard to get a hold of TB is because the point between when somebody starts developing TB and when they get detected is actually can be quite long. And in that period, they give it to their, you know, their kids, their community members that then have a latent disease that can sit undetected, you know, and contributes to a stock of latent disease that is in the population. And so, you know, early detection of TB, screening of TB, these are issues that I think, you know, would make a big difference for the global burden, and for which the research is actually. It's there, but it's kind of in some ways it's trickling. It's not as much as it should be given the burden and given how efficiently we can treat TB.
Yeah. So you identify two blocks. You have two factors that block the eradication of TB, which is detection and treatment. One way to go around it, which has been proven by history, is that TB incidence and prevalence decreased as nation started to develop and housing improved, and this without the treatment, without the detection, so shouldn't there be a priority into those things? Is there any research into this?
Well, you know, it's a good question, and I think, you know, you bring up all sorts of interesting historical patterns, right? In New York and around the, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s, TB was the number one cause of death in the tenements, and you see TB kind of receding from Europe. As people moved into bigger houses, as sanitary conditions improved, as people stopped, as you said, intermingling in ways that really promoted improved nutrition, and right. So now, the whether that can be replicated in areas where the current burden of TB is so high. My suspicion is that the burden of latent TB was never as high in New York as it is in South Africa, and so in some ways it receded. The fact that TB receded without treatment really pretty quickly over a course of maybe 20 or 30 years really nearly disappeared. It's a mystery for a lot of for public health, and TB is a real curiosity for a lot of people. My suspicion is that even some countries, as their nutrition improves, so South African nutrition has been improving for quite some time. Their economic conditions have improved. And we're not seeing TB recede in any kind of meaningful way. I hear your point, and I think it brings back this notion of the interconnectedness of social conditions, economic conditions with disease. And at the same time, I remain open about whether or not we're going to be able to make a big dent in TB without more modern medical technologies.
But you have another enemy, which is a multi-resistant TB,
right? I mean, for sure, right? And the MDR strains make it more difficult.
and it's also tied to HIV. Because in the HIV patient, they tended to have multi-resistant.
So for sure, all of that is true. And I think if we just but for me, kind of thinking about priority setting, kind of first order problem is just run of the mill standard TB, drug sensitive TB, and that's a big problem. We really need to take care of it. We haven't been able to quench it.
What would be the strategic solutions? And would you have a couple of experiences, that your personal experiences with that were successful, explaining why it was successful, and also the opposite when it was not successful.
Yeah, so I was involved with a book, a big project called The Disease Control Priorities, and I helped write the chapter on foreign aid, I think foreign aid is kind of it holds an interesting place because it is the way that in some ways we get involved in global health most directly. And it's a recognition that there are health issues and health priorities in other countries, and we want to help them because we're human beings. And of course there are other considerations, political considerations and whatnot. But foreign aid is a conduit for a lot of these ways of getting involved with global health. So then the question is, how do we make in which places has foreign aid been a success? And what are the strategic ways that you think about that? And here's what we came up with, and I think it's an important lesson. You have to consider the fact that the health of a population is the first entity that is in charge of the health of a population is the government of that country, right? The government of Uganda has a Ministry of Health and local health districts, the government is in some ways a fiduciary agent for the population, and the government and the population are together. They have a responsibility for one another. The people choose the government or in some ways enable the government. The government gives the people back. Okay. Foreign aid in some ways is a much trickier proposition because, what the U.S. gives to another country, it can go up or down. We don't have the same kind of sense of responsibility other than the humanitarian responsibility. And so it's a little bit more volatile. And so then you have to think, well, you know, how do we make best use of foreign aid? And so one of the key strategic directions that we came up with is look at areas of health where in some ways the government is underfunding. Okay, so an area where that is relatively overlooked, for which there's a certain technology, or let's say by technology I mean medicines or vaccines or something that can be deployed efficiently and equitably. And so there are some successes. I think actually HIV has been a success because it made a big difference, and there was an area that was undervalued. If you think about South Africa, in the early 2000s, you had President Mbeki at the time, essentially saying, look, we need to have our own solutions. And he had the Minister of Health, whose nickname was Dr. Beetroot, and she promoted things like beetroot and garlic for HIV, right? It was in some ways focusing on HIV was an area that was underfunded by a lot of governments. Now, what the kind of areas we see now, and I think are good strategic directions, are some of the newer vaccines. And so vaccines for RSV, for some of the pneumococcal vaccines that are potentially a little bit more expensive. They're not thought of in the basic basket of vaccinations for a lot of children. And Gavi is funding those, and I think those are can be great areas because they're not areas the government is funding. They're very effective. You can deploy them kind of piggyback with other vaccinations, and you can make a big difference. There are some areas that are for me a little bit curious about why we are not investing, and one of them is clean water. Clean water, it seems to me is one of these things that you can make a huge difference. In some ways, it's a technology where you don't need people's, if you can pipe clean water into people's homes or to a community well, if you can pipe clean water, then, people don't need to do anything. Just that, they get the water, it's clean. You reduce obviously diarrheal illnesses, pneumonias, parasitic infections, a lot of things.
And hygiene?
Hygiene, right? And hand hygiene can go along with it, right? You can wash your hands, right? You don't have to worry about that. So that seems to me an area, and I think it's clearly under prioritized by governments. You don't see governments putting in clean water pipes and filtration. So that's a strategic direction that I think we can move forward on.
Well, let me ask you two questions regarding this.
Yes.
The first one is, that's good if the foreign aid is reliable. So, because I give the example of Clinton Foundation, after Hillary was not Secretary of State any longer, it decreased 75%.
Totally.
So big disruption. Okay, so is there any funding trying to make those foundations, those donations not necessary, making those countries more independent? And the second, which is related to that, if the countries are not taking care of their own citizens, what about the idea of an international entity, which would not be WHO or something, would have to be created, that will have the right, international right, to intervene in those countries? Just like you have the blue helmet for war, you would have some brigades that would go, So what do you think about that?
No, I think it's a, it's an interesting idea. Okay, so I'll answer actually both of them in some way, and that is, I think I my sense, both from my work and from my scholarship and my reading, is that countries are interested in taking more ownership over their health sector for a few reasons. One is promoting health, providing health to communities. It's good politics. I think governments that are sometimes you see even So organizations that we think of as being, you know, kind of in many ways for us in the West here, unsavory, you know, Taliban, Boko Haram, they provide healthcare. And so my sense is that you know, that governments by and large want to take more ownership over their health sector. As you mentioned, with the Clinton Foundation, with other global health, it's unreliable, and so in some ways the government, you know, it can be more directly accountable, and so I support that. And so the question becomes, well, you know, what happens in, you know, again, like it's, you know, when areas are grossly underfunded or populations are ignored. I think it's an interesting idea. My sense is that you know, questions of governmental ownership over the health sector and over its dominion are going to come into play in a big way. Over the past decade or so, South Africa in some ways has taken much greater ownership over its HIV program. So that, you know, in some ways, PEPFAR in the U.S. is really playing a relatively small role in South Africa's HIV program. And, you know, I think by and large, that has worked well for the government, for the U.S., for the South African government. That, you know, they want to take ownership of that because, you know, they get to prioritize, you know, rural populations more. I think it's an interesting idea. I'm trying to think about what are the kinds of situations, and that, you know, the thing that kind of comes to mind are something like the Ebola crisis, where, you know, you what's in some ways what's called for is a very large increase in the capacity.
Also a famine.
Yeah, right. And so famine. You know, I mean, famines, I think, you know, issues of nutrition, I think, totally touch on this intersection between kind of social and political conditions and health, right? I mean, you know, if you look at some of the literature, even from Amartya Sen, you know, he claims that, you know, in his kind of scholarship and in his analysis, is that famines are largely political events. And by that, he means that governments that are responsible for their population, that, you know, are in some ways really good stewards of their population, they will find ways to distribute food. And so famines are, you know, in some ways it's almost like there's an area, there's a population that is isolated, almost like politically deliberately, from access to food structures.
Like a genocide.
A little bit.
It's a weapon.
In some ways.
It's a weapon. Yeah.
It's a weapon, right?
And so I would also, there's the issue of civil wars, but then I would have to ask Paul Weiss about that.
I work with Paul on civil wars. If you want to get into the issue of,
but then there are two more topics that I would like to broach. What about the mechanism of, because it seems to me that much of the research is from top to bottom, that the researcher at Stanford or Geneva or anywhere else, they come up with, okay, we have this thing and we should do some research on this and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work the other way around, bottom to top? The people on the ground telling you, hey, we have this problem here, we have this problem there. And some might not even be scientific, might just perception that are not real.
Totally. You know, it's a good question. You know, the two things I would say is, you know, again, I think an important priority. One is, you know, just always maintain both humility and respect for for both whether or not we know the issues, the real issues, the problems, and for the kinds of solutions that we're capable of identifying all the way from here. So, you know, so humility and respect are, I think, fundamental both to the kind of the conduct of research, to the scientists, as well as to maintaining good relations and maintaining, you know, sort of a certain openness about how the research happens. And the second thing I would say is go visit your friends in Rwanda and in Kenya and in South Africa and talk to them and get a flavor of that. Now, so that's, you know, that I think is key for informing the kind of research that we do. one important point that you raise, I think maybe implicitly, is, you know, should we in some way support research that happens in lower and middle income countries? And I think that's, you know, that's a great question. I think NIH is, again, you know, sort of identifying those as areas of priorities. There is now Howard Hughes Institutes and big NIH funded centers that are operating in sub-Saharan Africa and in India. I think those are, you know, those are in recognition of the fact that, you know, a lot of the research, in fact, it's better aligned with the needs and with the priorities of the local population if it comes from the local population and the local institutions. So
I would like to piggyback on what you said. You said the flavor. Go there and have a flavor of what's going on the ground. Well, flavor, to me, wouldn't cut it, because you have those stints. Well, I'm going to go do a stint in Ethiopia. I'm going to do a stint there. But to me, the most important thing is having boots on the ground. And this is not the way it's going. From what I'm seeing, it's business as usual in that area.
Yeah.
And the secondary question deriving from this is, since we don't have the information, you base the assessments and the policies on models, mathematical models and so on. And many of these models have proven to be wrong because they didn't know what was the real situation.
Totally. So, yeah, so what's my reaction to that? You know, the more time I spend in South Africa, the better my research will be informed. And there's no question. You know, I think it's you know, that the one thing that I think is kind of an increasingly interesting point on that is that you know, in so many ways, the kind of global health research that was done here at Stanford in California and Boston, wherever from the wealthier countries in the UK, was in some ways parachute research. You know, you fly somewhere but in some ways, like that kind of pattern of, you know, flying to a place, spending maybe a couple of weeks there, flying back, you know, not only is it hard to get a flavor of you know, a real flavor of, as you say, of what's going on, but it's now also getting into a lot of the issues around climate change and whatnot. You know, it's a lot of flying. It's a lot of, you know, and, you know, it makes up for a good chunk of sort of carbon emissions related to flights to lower income countries. And not to mention that, you know, I think researchers themselves would like to ensure that their carbon footprint is responsible in some way or another. You know, there are solutions around that. You can do carbon offsets and whatnot, but you know, that whole system of, you know, flying somewhere, you know, spending a couple of weeks going back, you know, it's a difficult system to think about sustaining and in some ways growing. So
we're talking about global health now that COVID supposedly, because I don't agree with that, is over. Everybody can't wait to resume the congresses, international meetings, and so on. And frankly, one lesson of COVID, we don't need that. We could do it virtually, and we'd have the same result.
Well, I'll tell you, you know,
what about the carbon imprint on it?
I'll tell you where you know, the thing that I both missed about COVID, and I miss actually about, you know, in some ways, like, peeling back some of the travel around global health, my global health research, is that, you know, I think there's been a benefit for me of having partners in Rwanda or in South Africa or in Kenya. One of the benefits is opening my eyes to you know, my friends and my colleagues' lives, and I think there's something that kind of human to human, person to person contact that, you know, in some ways, you know, allows you to really understand how things are done in different places better.
That's a different situation where you go and you learn, you go there to do the research.
Yeah.
Now, to sharing the result of the research in a congress, Okay.
By and large, I agree with you.
And the cost, not only the plane ticket, but the hotel, the
boarding, everything.
I mean, it's millions of dollars. Yeah.
One of my colleagues here had written, trying to get some kind of a back of the envelope estimate of the environmental footprint and the cost of these kinds of big international meetings. It's huge. Whether we need that. One way that we can potentially distinguish is, do we need that for the research and for the science? And maybe the answer is, maybe that not so much, because we can share the research in different avenues, but do we need that maybe for the contact, we have person-to-person contact? It might play an important role in our ability to connect with one another.
Okay, but you can meet people without going to a college.
No, I agree. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Aaron. I think it was very informative and enlightening, and I really enjoyed it. And I'll tell everybody, I'll see you next time for the next topic. And goodbye.
All right. Thank you, Ian.